comedian, actor, author, and podcaster Paula Poundstone. Paula Poundstone has been busy lately. She recently wrote a book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, which came out in May. Last month, in conjunction with NPR, she launched a new podcast. It's called Live from the Poundstone Institute. Plus, as always, she is constantly on the road doing a lot of stand-up comedy. She has 3 dates booked in Maine this summer and fall. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Paula Poundstone carves an hour out of her whirlwind schedule to spend some time with us. We'll ask her what it's like to be on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, why she's so interested in science these days, and why she loves Maine so much. What have you always wanted to ask Paula Poundstone? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Last Saturday, Paula Poundstone stunned the betting world with a come-from-behind victory in the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me news quiz. Fans of Paula, I'm sure, were not actually surprised by her win. She's multi-talented, after all, as evidenced by her new book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, and her new podcast, Live from the Poundstone Institute, and an incredibly active stand-up touring schedule. We are thrilled to have Paula joining us today from the studios of NPR West. Hi, Paula Poundstone.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, this
Can't wait to come to Maine, by the way.
Oh, good. I know you're coming 3 times in the next few months.
Yeah, and I was there a couple times over the summer also. I work these kind of tiny venues in Maine because they don't really have huge venues, and that's part of the joy of it. It's such a beautiful place. I look out across a sea of gray hair when I'm there, not because the people I perform to are any older than where other places that I play, but because they don't bother with silly stuff like hair dyeing a lot. Not everybody, but many. And there's something so refreshing about that, you know? They're just who they are. I love that.
That's a great insight. I haven't thought of us that way, but as always, we want to hear from you in the audience. If you'd like to talk to Paula Poundstone, is there a question you've always wanted to answer? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Paula will be performing at the Waterville Opera House this Friday and returns to Maine at the end of November. You can find information about her events, her podcast, and her book at the Maine Calling website and Facebook page. Paula Poundstone, I first became aware of you in 1989. I'm going to date myself here, but I was living in San Francisco. A comedy spot called The Other Cafe was closing, and some friends took me to the closing night tribute, and you were there on stage telling the funniest bit about men who whistle at women and, what do they expect to happen next. I still think about that bit when I hear a guy whistle at a gal. I hear Paula Poundstone saying, oh, yeah, I'll just come climb in your pickup truck. You don't even remember that, do you?
I don't remember that. I don't. I remember lots of things, but not that. I remember almost everyone from my second grade class list, but I don't remember that.
That's okay.
Of course, I have no one to argue with me about the second grade class list. There's nobody to, I remember things other people don't remember.
Well, it's because you do a different set every time, don't you?
I do. I do. I mean, against the backdrop of 38 years of material rattling around somewhere in my head, I figure my act is a little bit like one of those arcade games where you step into a glass booth and they blow paper money around, and whatever you can grab, you can keep. That's sort of my brain, maybe all day long, but certainly on stage, probably on any given night. Because, I have lots of topics that I talk about, I suppose, but my favorite thing to do is just talk to the audience. I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? And in this way, little biographies of audience members emerge, and I use that from which to set my sails. So I never quite know, where it's going to go or what I'm going to talk about on a good night, and I like to think some are. Probably a third is unique to just that audience.
So 38 years, something like 100 gigs a year. Is that about right?
maybe a little less, but yeah, yeah, 38 years of, yeah.
Do you ever just run, do you ever just stand there and think, you know what, tonight I don't got it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there have been times. Honestly, just a few weeks ago, I had, because I had been off. I had taken a week's vacation. And I'll tell you, it's very much like you know, playing a sport or working out. I think in that you know, take a little time off and you get a little rusty. You know, so if you're booking a show, if you want to go see a comic somewhere, or probably even a band would be the same, you know, find out when they vacationed and, you know, go after, like a little while, either before or after their vacation. Because, you know, if you go like the first day back, it can be a little raggedy. No, the other night I was on stage and I really was just like, I don't remember what I even used to talk about. Although I must say it still went just fine. But there was a part of me that felt like I was cooking without utensils.
Well, that's impressive. So you have a new podcast about science?
Well, sort of. It's a comedy podcast. It's, you know, on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the weekly news quiz show made by NPR, I'm lucky enough to be a regular panelist. And for those who don't know, it's a weekly news quiz show made by NPR. And there's three panelists each week, and we're asked questions about the week's news. And my boss, the host, Peter Sagal, will often say, he'll say, well, we read about a study this week. And then he'll tell some unlikely piece of information that, you know, that came from some sometimes kind of odd sounding study. And I always stop him. I always say, wait a minute, where did you hear that? You know, what school did that study, or what, you know, what scientific body did that study? And sometimes he knows, you know, a little bit about it, and sometimes he doesn't know that much about it. So somebody, and it's always fun. I mean, it's always funny to talk about them. And so somebody came up with the idea of me having the opportunity to talk directly to the scientists or the researchers that work on these things. And so live from the Poundstone Institute, we tape in front of a live audience. It is a comedy podcast, but backbone of it is me talking to scientists that do studies. For example, there was a study done where they wanted to know if mountain lions were afraid of people, you know. And so they played voices, and they tested it with they used a speaker system. And they want to know if they were afraid of our voices. So they used a speaker system. They played other sounds on the speaker system to get like a bass line. And then they played people from CNN and Fox News to these mountain lions. And the mountain lions ran away. I guess they used these voices because they were voices that, you know, talked for long periods of time. And so maybe that's why they chose them. But it turns out that mountain lions, and by the way, apparently it wasn't content, because they were equally afraid of the people on the left as they were of the people on the right, which just goes to show what mountain lions know, because trust me, it's only the people on the left that are going to protect them. So anyway, so we had the scientist who ran that experiment on live from the Poundstone Institute. And of course, some of it just cries out for jokes, even though the science is, in most cases, perfectly legitimate.
I was struck by, when I was doing the research for this program, you have a podcast that you just have been talking about, the Live from the Poundstone Institute, which is billed as a quest to gather all of the world's knowledge. And your new book is the totally unscientific study of the secret for human happiness. So you're trying to find
the search for human happiness.
I couldn't read my own handwriting. So the search for human happiness. So you're trying to gather all of the knowledge in the world and discover the inside information about human happiness. I was thinking those are kind of ambitious goals for one person.
Well, they are, and I'm tired a lot. This could explain it. You know, if I go to the doctor, you know, they say, how are you feeling? I say, well, you know, I've been on an exhaustive search an exhaustive study of the search for human happiness and trying to gather all the world's knowledge. So I may need an iron supplement.
Does your doctor even respond?
No, I don't have a regular doctor, actually. I occasionally go to an urgent care. And the good thing about that, it's sort of strangers on a train. You know, generally I never speak to the same person again. So I can say whatever I want. They look at me kind of oddly, and that's that.
Well, since you've been on this quest for the rest of us, especially the search for human happiness, have you found it? Can you elucidate? Can you help us all out?
Well, yeah, a little bit I can. You know, in my book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, what I decided to do was experiments in things that I or other people thought would make me happy. Each chapter is written as an experiment. There's the get fit experiment and the get up and help experiment and the get wired experiment. And each one is written using, conditions and hypotheses and variables and hopefully the funniest field notes ever written. But my real question wasn't whether or not I would enjoy doing something. My real question was, what could I do that would give me some sort of a bounce, you know, that would give me a little lasting, leave something in the tank when I was done doing it, so that when I returned to the inevitable slings and arrows of my daily life, that I would, you know, still feel some uplift. And so the analysis section of each chapter is me documenting what happens when I return to my life, raising a house full of kids and animals, being a stand-up comic, and just being stuck being me 24 hours a day. I was really hoping that the answer was going to be just sitting in a chair watching movies all day. But I checked it out, and it isn't. I checked it out with my lab assistants that day, my children. For the most part, they didn't participate in any experiments. But when I told them about that experiment, they were very excited about it. And so we did watch movies, DVDs, videos, because some of it was TV shows that we had on video. But we did watch for, I think it was something like 16 hours in a row.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, we took a couple of chore breaks because I have 14 cats. And if you don't stop and sift, then I think that, then that's altering the experiment in a natural way, an unnatural way.
This is the next question. You have 14 cats? 14?
Yes.
Why do you have 14 cats?
Oh, because I had 16 and two died.
What are their names?
Well, let's see.
Can you remember?
I do remember. I can't always do it all at once. There's Hardy, ShamWow, Belle, Severus, Gem, Oreo, Brittle, Fez, Theo, Harrison, Luigi, Wednesday. Now, see, I'm going to feel awful if there's two I can't remember. Clue. And Tonks.
Tonks. I don't think they understand English anyway.
I think that's the first time I've done them all in a row, because people ask me all the time, and I usually just choke and freeze. You know, if you were to ask me to list my kid's name, if it was, you know, in a testing circumstance, surely I would leave one of them out.
Well, you revealed in your book that you have terrible allergies. How does somebody with terrible allergies have 14 cats?
Well, I don't think I'm allergic to cats per se, although when you have that many, you're literally just inhaling clumps of fur sometimes. So, anybody is allergic to 14, I think. I don't know. I don't think I have specific cat allergies. I have allergies to things that are, you know, like what they tell me at the, I did go to an allergist one time. It was the biggest waste of money, by the way. Dust mites. That's it. The lady told me I was allergic to dust mites. She said I had to. She said, well, you know, she took out a catalog that I could order like special linens from that would protect me from the dust mites that she was certain were in my mattress. But I don't sleep on a mattress. So although I may be reacting to dust mites, it's not there. I sleep on the floor. And then when I go to a hotel, I sleep in a bed. And I said, but I sleep in hotels a lot. And she goes, bring it with you. Oh, yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing. I am going to a hotel with my own linens and saying, yes, I'd like to, you know, I'm checking into room 302. And they're like, oh, the rooms aren't ready yet. That's okay. I'll do it myself.
I'm sure there are people who are out there who do travel with it, though. I mean, really. Anyway. I have to ask you, because this past weekend you won the Wait, Wait news quiz, and I wanted to ask where that ranks on your, you know, life accomplishments list.
It was very exciting. And I have to say, it wasn't just that I won. It's that I think I got all of my answers correct. You know, it was a stunning victory, likes of which, and I hate to use the same words that our president uses, but the likes of which have never been seen on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me before. Other people have gotten all their answers right, but I never have. So that's the part that's never been seen on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Was there an after party?
There was not. You know, in fact, it was really handled. I guess it was like when people meet a celebrity, but they want to seem really cool. And so they sort of pretend that they don't notice. It wasn't even an asterisk, I don't think, that night. It was just everyone just sort of moved on to whatever the others were like, yeah, we're going to go for a drink. You want to come? No, I have to pack. And that was it. Yeah, it was very, I am preparing, a date in my own calendar to celebrate it. Yeah.
Good. And you can invite the people in the audience who actually cheered and celebrated with you.
Yeah, I think I should. It is a rare occurrence for me to win to begin with, but it's never been done that I answered all the questions correctly. By the way, I thought that they were particularly easy questions, because sometimes I listen to other people's questions and they strike me as very easy. And then other people, the answer is Afghanistan, Trump. Or North Korea, Trump. I feel that's a little too easy.
Okay, well, we'll contact the producers and let them know. Paula, you were an early adopter of Twitter. How do you feel about Twitter?
I have mixed feelings. I have a love-hate with Twitter. Because I'm a total hypocrite, that's why. Because the truth is, social media is not good for us. That's the raw, unvarnished truth. It really isn't. People need to look at each other. They need to talk to each other. They need to put down their flat things and interact, greet one another. I think every day should take place like the opening scene of Beauty and the Beast, bonjour, bonjour, bonjour. But we have sort of moved away from one another in a way, and it's been, I don't know, supplemented isn't the right word, but with this thing that is to social life and emotional well-being what Doritos are to nutrition. And by the way, I love Doritos. Having said that, in fact, in my book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, as I said, I did things that other people, sometimes that other people thought would make me happy. At the time of writing that book, and it took me 7 years to write, and it came out last May. At the time of writing that book, when I did an experiment learning to use computers, because although we had a big computer at our house at the time, I didn't even know how to turn it on. I had an assistant who did she used to print out my emails on paper, and I would answer it and give it back to her, and she would type it into that horrible machine.
Oh my gosh.
And I have, in fact, I wrote 3 math workbooks and my other book, which is called There's Nothing in This Book That I Meant to Say. I wrote those all by hand, and I handed them to a typist who typed them into that horrible machine. So I did. Everybody kept telling me, oh, you'll love computers. Oh, you'll love email. Oh, it's all going to be so great. So I did an experiment where I really was starting as a blank slate, learning to use a computer. I bought a laptop because you can take it door to door and beg for help, whereas a large computer, you have to lure someone into your home. Yeah, I thought so. And it's interesting because I didn't know what I know now while I was doing that experiment. But a lot of the information about how these things are affecting us are just now starting to see the light of day anyways. But as I was writing, and I really did keep detailed field notes about this experiment, and as writing, I found I kept using words like exhausted, addicted. I couldn't stop looking at the silly, stupid thing. I started with Facebook before I moved to, before I found Twitter. And, you know, I would feel this pent-up need. Like if I was in the car and couldn't get to the silly, stupid computer, I would get anxious. And I began recording these things like right from the very start of using these machines. And so I know for now when science is beginning to tell us that, oh, actually, they're not good for you at all. I go, oh, yeah, I can kind of see that. All right. Now, having said all that, I do enjoy writing jokes and putting them up on Twitter. because I'm a terrible hypocrite. I do. I like thinking of things that I think are funny and posting them. You know, the sad sort of mentally ill part of it is that I insist on looking and seeing how many people responded. And the truth is, it doesn't matter. You know, if I go on stage and I tell a joke, I mean, I guess I do hear the crowd response, and that's really uplifting and fun and stimulating. I don't ask people to count off. I don't say, like, you know, how many of you...
How many of you are laughing?
Yeah. How many likes did I get on that? No, I guess, in fact, because you can hear a bigger response to some things and a smaller, I guess you're still making this quantitative measurement. But part of the way they make these things addictive, and they are deliberately addictive. So as people have been sort of quietly suffering with it, I think a lot of people have felt shame about it, haven't wanted to tell anybody that they're addicted. But it is deliberate. It is. They were designed that way to begin with. And one of the techniques that they use is this quantitative measurement that we really all get hooked into.
Yes.
And it works with everything. Like I check, my manager turned me on to checking the Amazon listings for my book.
What a terrible idea.
It's a horrible idea. It really is. Because the other thing is,
because people are buying it at independent bookstores.
Well, that's one of the reasons it's a horrible idea is that, yeah, you know what? I like bookstores. I want bookstores to be there. I don't want everything bought on Amazon anyways. But the other thing is, you know, as I look at this listing and I see like, you know, and they have subcategories. It's a little bit like when my kids were in gymnastics, you know, no one goes home a loser. They have subcategories. So there's the top 100 sales, and then there's the top 100 sales within comedy. And then within comedy, it's like, well, was it comedy about self-help? Was it comedy? So, you know, eventually you're going to find your book in some category. You just can't help it mathematically. But I find myself bitter towards the other books. And I'm not sure that that's healthy. You know, because my book right now, my book has a blue cover. So as I scan the list, I'm looking for the blue cover. You know, I'm hoping to find it in the early numbers. But, you know, and then there's books that don't even belong in that category. You know, I'm like, I'm under comedy and there's Diary of Anne Frank. I'm like, what the hell is Anne Frank doing there? And by the way, didn't her book already have a turn? Yeah, it makes you hostile towards people who don't deserve your hostility.
Well, here's a number. I was supposed to take a break 5 minutes ago.
Oh,
so I'm
going
to take the break. And then when
I
we come back, we'll talk about Twitter some more with Paula Poundstone. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Lighting Concepts, now open in Portland and Lewiston, dedicated to lighting Maine homes with style and function. And Waterville Opera House, presenting the rock opera One Way Trip to Mars, featuring an 11-piece orchestra, August 24th through 27th. OperaHouse.org.
Hey, it's Luke Burbank, host of Livewire from PRI. We're your weekly dose of music, comedy, and stimulating conversation from people like Lemony Snicket children's author Daniel Handler, who has some really helpful advice for his readers.
Kids, eat a little something before you drink a lot of bourbon.
It's all taped in front of a live audience in Portland, Oregon. That's Livewire Radio, radio variety for the attention span challenged. From PRI.
Coming up tomorrow evening at 11 o'clock.
Hi, this is David Greene. Now, many of you know my voice really well. Some of you probably wake up to me. I mean, who knew that one of the perks of this job was all this pillow talk? Well, since you and I are close, I'm going to make a bold suggestion. When it's time to unload your current car, instead of trading it in, why don't you donate it to this station? Believe it or not, we can turn it into Morning Edition, All Things Considered, or Radiolab. It's easy. Here's how.
You just visit mainpublic.org and click on support. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Paula Poundstone. You know her from stand-up comedy and from her frequent appearances on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She joins us from the studio of NPR West. I have a quick correction. Her performance this weekend in Waterville is Saturday night. Saturday night, Paula Poundstone will be at the Waterville Opera House. She's coming back to Maine in November, and I believe at Stone Mountain Arts and in Agunquit. So, all that is online. If you'd like to join us today, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, Paula, we were talking about Twitter, and I understand you tweeted a photo of the eclipse today. Can you see into the future?
Yeah, I have already experienced the eclipse, and so I took a picture of it because I was.
Well, everything comes first in California, right?
Yes, exactly. It does, by the way. I was listening to KPCC, the public radio here in one of our public radio stations here in Los Angeles, on my way down to do this interview, and they were saying we'll take, you know, they were talking about the kind of coverage they were going to have of the eclipse, and you could post your pictures, and I thought, well. I think I could already post a picture of what the eclipse is going to look like. So yeah, I just tweeted it out. I hope it doesn't. You know, I feel like a spoiler. I hope I don't wreck it for everybody.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah. And in The Wizard of Oz, it's a dream. She wakes up.
We have an email from Beverly. When a brilliant one-liner occurs to you, but something interrupts the moment and you don't get to deliver the line, do you just swallow it or find a way to sneak it into the conversation later? And then she writes, I live in Camden, Maine, but grew up in Santa Monica, California, so I probably know your neighborhood. Woo-hoo.
Oh, I would definitely. First of all, I would bring a conversation to a dead stop in order to be able, if I had a thought, to put it out there. I interrupt a lot. I have a problem with that. B, I talk a tremendous amount. You know, they should have used me to frighten the mountain lions in that experiment. although I will say, you know, that is one of the things, like when I'm alone, and I'm alone a lot because of my job, because of traveling, you know, when I'm alone, I think of stuff all the time. And so that has been one, I don't know if it's an asset of Twitter, I feel like it's like a steam valve sometimes, you know, like you have a thought and this way here, it goes out. I write it on Twitter and then I sort of forget about it. So it's not bothering me all day long.
Speaking of tweets,
rattling around. Yes,
we have tweets. We have one that says, tell Paula we love her. And another that says, been a fan since the Pop-Tart years.
All right. I was actually, there was a videotape of me and a couple of my cohorts, too, that was available if you bought like a certain amount of, you know, you sent in Pop-Tarts box tops many years ago. And so, you know, a lot of really fat people come up to me and say, you know, I bought your videotape years ago by eating tons of Pop-Tarts. I feel a little guilty about that.
We'll go to Corey, who's calling from Kittery, Maine. Hi, Corey. Go ahead.
Hey, Paula.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Hey, I already knew you were super cool, and I loved you,
Thank you.
You have reached a new pinnacle for me.
Why is that?
I also have a cat named ShamWow as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
Boy, that is a rare connection. Well, like when we go to the people with cats named Chat,
I said this lady is just fantastic.
Yeah, well, it's great minds for sure. I started saying when we go to the people with cats named ShamWow Club, it's going to be just you and me, I think.
I think so.
Yeah. Corey, what does your cat look like?
He is a very light orange tiger cat.
Okay, what about yours, Paula?
His name's ShamWow. Oh, he was named that way because he kind of looked like a chamois cloth.
Ah.
I named my cat ShamWow because I clean with her. I'm thinking of getting another cat named Swiffer. Yeah, no, my cat ShamWow looks like a long-haired calico. She's a very strange-looking cat, actually. She has some. She's not all long hair. She'll have like a patch of short and then a patch of long. Like, yeah, there was some commingling going on there.
Corey, thanks for your call. Our number 1-800-399-3566. John from Waterville wants to ask you, Paula, if you can talk about Mary Tyler Moore. You all were friends.
We were friends. Yes. I met her at a George Slaughter years ago put together a show. It was like some sort of tribute to comedy show of some sort. I can't even remember what it was called anymore. And I was lucky enough to be a part of it. I can't remember even what I did. But Mary Tyler Moore was going to be on the, you know, one of the people on the show. And I was so excited. And my daughter, Allie, who is now 23, was just an infant. And I took her with me to the rehearsal just so I could get a picture of me and Mary Tyler Moore. And that's how we met and working on that show. And I used to write to her and she'd write me back. And then we, you know, called one another. Well, I called her on the phone. She never got a moment where she went, oh, let me call Paula Poundstone. But when my kids were real little, she invited us up to her house to visit. And my girls were really young back then. And Mary's house was like a showplace of like antiques and, you know, beautiful design. And we broke so many things.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because the girls were. And by the way, I would say it was entirely the girls' fault, but I kept breaking stuff, too. And when we laughed about it years later, Mary said she didn't remember my kids breaking stuff. She just remembered me breaking stuff. I'm like, no, they started it. I'm telling you, every day that we were there, I had to go to her sheepishly and go, listen, I'll pay for it. But, you know, the soap dish, they had a soap dish with little angels, like, you know, the ones that you're not supposed to use. They're just decorative. And I don't know, we were in the bathroom and I wasn't paying enough attention to what the kids were doing. And I look over and all the little angel soaps had their faces washed off. It was traumatic. She was wonderful. She was one of my favorite performers ever. It's funny. One time when, I don't know, Allie must have been in about high school or something. And I was showing her the Mary Tyler Moore show on videotape. And as we're watching, the tape broke. And we were disappointed. But so I wrote to Mary and I said, the most horrible thing has happened. I told her that the videotape broke. I swear, like a couple of days later, comes FedEx package with the Mary Tyler Moore shows on DVD.
Oh, fun. That's great. How many people had that sent to them by Mary Tyler Moore? We're going to go to Peter, who's calling from West Baldwin. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're on the line with Paula Poundstone.
Hi there. Hi, Paula.
Hey.
Hi, I just wanted to ask. I know where you're from. You grew up in Sudbury, Mass.
Yes.
Which wasn't too far from where I lived. But as a child, did you dream of becoming a comedian?
Was that
like your dream?
Yes, it absolutely was. I wasn't sure how to go about doing that, but the first sentence of the last paragraph in the summary letter written by my kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Bump, in May of 1965, says, I have enjoyed many of Paula's humorous comments about our activities. And I think I always loved the sound of laughter, and I always loved the idea that I could make someone laugh, particularly make an adult laugh, was very exciting to me. And so, yes, I wanted to be. I wanted to be Mary Tyler Moore or Lily Tomlin or Lucille Ball or Carol Burnett or Gilda Radner. And by the way, I missed by a country mile, but that's what I wanted.
I wouldn't say you missed by a country mile. Did you have somebody who was funny in your family, or did you just sort of look at the world differently on your own from the beginning?
I think my dad had a clever sense of humor. I didn't always know he was kidding, I think, probably. You know, my grandfather was funny. I didn't spend a lot of time with my grandparents. They lived in West Virginia, and we visited them, I don't know, maybe once a year when we were little and less when we got older. But I remember when if he didn't hear something, and he was hard of hearing, but if he didn't hear something, he would always say, like, if I said to him, like, oh, you know, I swam on the swim team this summer, granddad, he'd go, shot who? And I never got the joke. I was always going, well, no, I didn't shoot anybody. It took me a really long time to understand that this was both his way of saying I didn't hear you and a joke. Maybe I had lots of funny members of my family and I was just too dense to know it.
Well, perhaps, but I doubt it. We're talking with Paula Poundstone on Maine Calling. We do have to take another short break, but first, a note about tomorrow's show. We're going to be talking about museums in Maine, and we want to know which are your favorites, which are the hidden gems. Email your recommendations to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. That's tomorrow on Maine Calling, and we'll be right back with Paula Poundstone.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does MEMIC, a workers' compensation insurance company dedicated to safer workplaces, fair treatment for all workers, and a strong Maine economy. On the web at MEMIC.com.
So I go home and I tell my mother, and I say, Ma, I'm not going to be a doctor. I'm going to work to clean up hazardous waste. I'm going to be an engineer. My grandmother said, baby, why do you want to work on a train?
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour, true stories told live from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
You can hear the Moth Radio Hour this evening at 11 or Sunday afternoon at 1 right here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up in just a few minutes at the top of the hour at 2 o'clock, we'll have World Affairs. The speaker is Rick Wartzman, author of The End of Loyalty, The Rise and Fall of Good Jobs in America. The American Dream was built on a corporate social contract that guaranteed good jobs for workers and loyalty for employers. But this is no longer the norm. His book chronicles the erosion of the relationship between major American businesses and their workers. Job security, regular pay increases, and comprehensive health benefits may be relics of the past. That's author Rick Wartzman on World Affairs coming up at 2 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Paula Poundstone. She has a new book out, a new podcast, and will be in Waterville this Saturday at the Waterville Opera House. You can find out all about the events and activities at her website, paulapoundstone.com, or on the Maine Calling Facebook page or website. In the meantime, join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. A couple more tweets, Paula. Met Paula in Portland 8 years ago in the elevator at the Holiday Inn. My baby was with me. You had cool teal boots. And then
That could have been me. Yeah.
And then from Twitter, are Paula and Peter Sagal friends on Wait, Wait?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I love Peter. We did a show, I guess, was it last week, maybe? I can't even remember who was on the panel. It might have been me, Alonzo Bowden, and maybe Tom Baudette, maybe. But anyways, Peter and I were talking at one point back and forth, and Alonzo said, how long have the two of you been married? Because apparently we do talk on the show a bit like an old married couple. One of the joys of my life is the look on Peter Sagal's face when I say things he doesn't understand. And I say a lot of things he doesn't understand. Peter is a brilliantly he's a brilliant man. He's very, very, very smart. And I am not so much. And so a lot of what I say just baffles him. He just doesn't understand why anybody would say the things I say. I don't know all the things he knows. And so I muddle through life with a bit of confusion. But I just love the look on his face when he's just like, well, why would you say that?
We're going to go to David, who's calling from Dixmont. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi there. First of all, I wonder if Paula's cat is the one that she used to have the squirt gun incident with in part of her discipline thing and the shower story. But you were commenting a little minute ago about making adults laugh. And I want to tell you, I used to travel a lot on airlines. I don't do that anymore. But they have these little radio things you can listen to, different music and all that. And there's a comedy channel. And lots of times you were on it. And I could tell you that you could tell who was listening to you because all of a sudden, all over the plane, people would spontaneously laugh all at once.
Oh, that is so nice to hear. Thank you.
David,
David, what are you doing now that you don't travel on planes anymore?
I'm in my greenhouse. I'm a farmer, and I'm clipping up tomatoes right now.
Oh, wow. Nice. That sounds a lot better than traveling on planes, I got to tell you.
That's right. I'm about half an hour from Waterville, so if you need any tomatoes, let me know, and I'll bring some down.
Oh, sounds good.
Polly, you spend a lot of time on planes.
I spend a lot of time on planes, yes. I feel, you know, and, all right, two things. There is nothing in this world that would make me wear that neck pillow.
Oh!
I just won't do it. But the other thing is, it wouldn't help me anyways because my head falls forward. And, you know, I've had trouble with my spine because of that fact. Because
well, you could turn the horseshoe around.
Well, that's what people have said to me, but it doesn't work. I would rather I would rather have spine trouble than wear that. Before the broken neck. I know it wouldn't help anyways, because I actually did try that one time and I'm like, well, this is ridiculous. You know, I'm going to smother, but it's not going to protect my. Yeah, it doesn't. I saw one time. Remember the magazine thing? The company went out of business a little while ago. Remember, was it Sky Mall? Remember
yes.
The Sky Mall? It's a damn shame they went out of business because that was the only entertaining thing to do on a plane other than look out the window at our beautiful Earth was to look at that catalog. But they did have at one point some sort of gizmo I saw advertised one time, some sort of like metal, you hook it to the chair thing that would hold your head up for those whose head lists forward. It looked a little bit like one of those halo things that someone wears when they have a broken neck. And there were times I was in enough pain where I might seriously have considered doing that. I won't wear the goofy pillow thing because I don't want to seem rude to listeners or fans that may enjoy the goofy pillow thing. But, you know, people don't even take it off when they get off the plane. They just walk around with it. They put it on their children with like a giraffe head coming off of it. It's not as attractive as they may think.
We'll go to David. Thanks for your call. We're going to go to Raymond and Tim. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Hi, Paula. How are you?
Hey, Tim. Good.
I wanted to thank you on a couple of things. First of all, your bit about the Flintstone glasses from way back when. I don't want to date myself, but my answer, you know, after having kids and they should have been, you know, test dummies for products that break all the time. My answer to everything is we just can't have nice things.
I'm very flattered. That's what my mother said when I broke the Flintstones glass. She said, damn it, we can't have nice things.
That's exactly it. And I do remember collecting those myself from the green stamps, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And no, there was a thing where you when you ate the jelly, you could use the jar as a glass.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's right. That's right.
What, yeah. I wish they would bring that back, actually. That was a great thing.
Yeah, that's old-fashioned recycling, I guess. But about Maine people, you're spot on about that. We moved up here about 15 years ago from Connecticut when the kids were real little, and I didn't want to expose them to all the affluenza and all that was starting in kindergarten, where they would, you know, have to compete with the girls that were buying new dresses for the back-to-school prom, apparently, in kindergarten.
Yeah.
Moved up here,
yeah.
And immediately noticed just how unbothered people were. That's not a word, but just how they were just so easy being themselves, and they really didn't care who you were, where you came from, or what you did. They accept you for who you are, and it's been a magnificent journey ever since. So you're right on about that.
Thanks,
Tim.
Oh,
I'm so happy for you.
And
Maine is a cool place.
Just like L.A., right?
Oh, yeah, just like L.A.
Yeah. Tim, thanks for your call. We have an email from Meredith. Says 14 cats. Wow. Any other pets? Lizards, goats, birds, horses?
I did have a bearded dragon lizard for years. He died a couple years ago. And then I have two German Shepherd mixed dogs. And they're not my pets, but I have a beehive in my birdhouse. I love standing out there watching them. There's only a hole, two holes in the birdhouse that you can see through to see them. But, you know, they don't bother you because they're working really hard, which I know from the Bee Movie. They're just zipping in and out of that house all the time, working their little bee buns off.
We have a caller who says who fell off the line, who says she wants to know how you handle 14 litter boxes.
Well, I don't have 14 litter boxes, which could be part of my problem. I have like a giant, I got a pan that is used for mixing cement. It's just a big, huge, you know, plastic bin. And I have that. And then I have three of the hooded litter box things. And I sift four times a day.
Oh my gosh!
I have
not
a callus
a very glamorous
on my hand.
Life.
No, I have a very, very unglamorous life. In fact, and I think about that all the time. I think, what am I missing? I have no money, and I have to clean all the time. What have I done wrong?
We'll go to Vivian in the Belgrade Lakes. Hi, Vivian. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Paula. Hey. I am Vivian. I'm a rabbi. I live in Philadelphia, so I work on Saturday mornings. The highlight of my week is when I have a Saturday morning off and you are on the panel of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
I am very flattered.
Oh. Well,
thank you. Hey, Vivian, do you watch Orange is the New Black?
Do I watch what?
A show, I guess not. It's a show. It's a Netflix show. It's called, and I don't watch it on Netflix. I don't know how to use Netflix. I bought it on,
right.
I bought it on DVD. It's called Orange is the New Black.
Oh, I've heard about it, but I don't really have, I haven't read it or watched it. Would you recommend it?
I do, but the thing is, I mean, I know almost nothing about Judaism, but one of the most moving sort of storylines and scenes in the book is where this, one of the characters is accepted into the Jewish religion, and it's very, very beautiful.
Wonderful, Paula.
I would recommend that.
I put it down. I am definitely going to read it, watch it. Your recommendation, you know, like there's nothing better than that, Paula.
I don't know about your, you know, your taste sphere. So I don't know if the whole thing will appeal to you or not. I think it is an absolutely brilliant show. But it's worth checking out if for no other reason than to find that there are gaps in the things we have in common.
Vivian, thank you so much for your call today. We have from Wendy on email, I love you on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I wish you were on every week. Will you tell us a little bit about your family and home life? Well, we know you have 14 cats and you have dogs and you have bees and you have kids. Is there anything else that we haven't talked about?
What else could there be? my family and home life. Yeah, you know, when you have 14 cats and two German Shepherd mixed dogs, really a tremendous amount of my life is just cleaning. The thing about cleaning is that it's also, I consider it writing, because the truth is it's mindless work, and so your mind drifts. And it's probably where I come up with some of my best ideas, should I ever have a good idea. It's probably while I was, you know, scrubbing the floor or, you know, bleaching something or sifting. A lot of my best work gets done while sifting.
Oh, my gosh. From Lois on Facebook, just listening to you. And speaking of Pop-Tarts, I was in the Dublin airport this summer and saw a youngish man eating them two at a time. It reminded me of your routine on video. I never thought I would see someone eating them two at a time. Cracked me up. So there you go. You have people laughing at strangers all over the world, Paula.
There, that is a comfort. Actually, you know what's weird? I used to do this bit about the Pop-Tart packaging and how ingenious it was, because they had three pouches of two, and the pouches were not resealable, and so you All right, what happened is you'd eat the first Pop-Tart and you'd enjoy it very much, but because you couldn't reseal the package, you'd think to yourself, well, I have to eat the second one or it will go stale. So now you've eaten two and it's no longer just a snack. It's a meal. And then you may as well have two more so that you complete the meal. And then you're really full at that point. Now you've had four Pop-Tarts. You're full. But there's just two Pop-Tarts hanging out in a box, and it just doesn't feel right. So you eat the last two just to tidy up, really. And I've talked about this for many, many years on stage. Well, recently, not recently, but in the last several years anyways, Pop-Tart came out with a box with eight Pop-Tarts instead of six.
Oh.
Which means, like so many companies that have no idea what was good about what they had to begin with, you don't have to eat. I don't have to eat.
Right,
eight
it could
Pop-Tarts.
Last you for two meals now.
Right, exactly. Now you can stop at four. So, yeah, they kind of shot themselves in the foot a little. Plus, you know, I got to say, I mean, I'm a brown sugar and cinnamon frosted person. Maybe, you know, strawberry frosted in a pinch. But they have some flavors now that shouldn't even be legal, for heaven's sakes. You know, they've made up berries I never even heard of. It's a Hyman Berry Pop-Tart. What the hell is that? There's
oh
no
gosh.
Such thing, I don't think. Or, you know, s'mores or shepherd's pie. They just have stuff that is not a Pop-Tart anymore.
We have less than 2 minutes left, but I have an email from Griffin I have to ask you. What makes Paula laugh?
I have a really cheap sense of humor. I don't think I've ever laughed harder than seeing a woman come out of the restroom with a piece of toilet paper stuck to the bottom of their foot. And especially when they only went in to check their makeup.
Well, Paula,
so, yeah, I have a very lowbrow sense of humor, really.
Paula Poundstone, thanks so much for joining us today. Paula Poundstone, the author of The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, and a new podcast live from the Poundstone Institute. And you can see her this Saturday at the Waterville Opera House. If you can't make it this Saturday, she returns to Maine for two more shows in the state in late November. Nikki Shields ran the board today. The show is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Thank you, Paula.
Thank you. It was fun.
It was fun. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about the museums of Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.